freaking auto!
This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says?
No, he's not a friend.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
Ah, we stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No way!
Well, here we go with another Brock and Salk podcast. Another quarantine podcast.
You could change it to locked in a room with Howdy.
That's what it feels like.
Oh, Howdy's back again, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, very cool.
You want an update on the house next door?
Yes. The garbage cans?
Still there.
Oh.
No change. But they are the workers are still working.
Okay.
So there's hope.
Where are they going to work on? I saw the picture you sent of me.
I think they're doing like a French drain or something.
Okay.
I don't really know what that is. Does anyone else know what a French drain is?
French drain doesn't really go past the wall. It's supposed to go before.
Well, no, I think they're doing a French drain on the inside. And so, I don't know. The retaining wall is part of that, I think.
Okay.
So maybe when they're done with the French drain, they're going to take their garbage cans and move them inside.
Okay.
But in the meantime, there's just garbage cans right in front of their brand new retaining wall in front of their house. It's
gross.
Terrible.
Yeah, you sent the picture to all of us, and clearly the retaining wall cutout was made for those garbage cans.
It's what it looks like, right?
I mean, there's no question about it. Howdy, Kyle, myself, we're all in what Molly Huard would say is a grill. We are all in a grill.
Have you had a conversation with Molly about that?
I've had conversations, but she's just rolling with it. So she's going.
Are you
that
conversating
word.
About it? I mean,
yeah, we were conversating about it. How okay. a maniacal it is that she uses a grill.
Right. Okay. I mean, it was bad enough. But when I think agreeance, which isn't a word, and turning it into a grill.
That's right. Okay. That's right. But we I think all do agree that clearly the design element of your neighbors.
I'd post
wall.
That photo, but I don't want people to see my name. I don't want rioting outside of my neighbor's house. It doesn't seem right to them, right? I mean, I'm trying to be a good neighbor. I'll complain, obviously, to you,
right.
But I don't need like people with pitchforks attacking my neighbor's new retaining wall.
You should just find other pictures of people who have done that in different places and post and say,
right.
Theoretically,
here's
what
the
do you think of this?
Here's the problem with that plan. No one else has done this because it's obnoxious. Nobody puts their garbage cans in a special spot in front of their front wall. It's bizarre.
Ugh.
All right. I'm sorry. I don't mean to. I bored everybody with this last week. I'm sorry to do it 2 weeks in a row. This isn't a repeat. This is actually a new show. And this is we're not quite at the show before the draft, but we're getting very close to that. This is a very draft heavy show. I have a ton of draft questions for the expert, Howdy, obviously. I mean,
right.
The man.
Yes. If you guys didn't know, I've been doing mock drafts. I'm on About Mock Draft 82. I have an article up on 710sports.com.
Yes. All right, Howdy's now the draft expert in our building. Can I tell you a quick story? So when I first was trying to get into this business, okay, I went to work, I interned for Ryan Russillo at 1510 The Zone in Boston. It was a sporting news radio station that did not work. It had a signal, well, you could hear it in the ocean, but not like... in Boston, which is a bit of a problem. But they had the rights to the Celtics, and they had spent a bunch of money at the beginning. All that had gone away. It was a disaster by the time I got there. And by the way, that was like the Rick Pitino Celtics. Like, they weren't good. So at the end, they were taking time buys, right? So I bought some time on the station to try to like help myself start my career. With these
you bet
two,
on yourself.
I did. With these two guys who I met there. and we did a show. I think it was called The Fan Club, I want to say it was called. I'm kind of blanking on the name, but I think it was The Fan Club or Further Review or something like that. I forget what the heck it was called. In any event, they wrote bios for themselves, and one of them, his name was AJ, had this bio that was that called him like a draft expert with like a legacy of success in the draft. And I remember showing it to somebody, and they were like, what? What does that even mean? Like, what? That's Howdy.
That's right.
Howdy's the same thing. He's just decided he's a draft expert with some level of like proven commodity in the draft.
And yet all of you people who don't pay close enough attention, you don't even realize that all it takes is just a little bit of study because you can't come at me. You can't disprove me.
Sure,
you have
I can.
No information.
You know what I can
absolutely
do?
Absolutely none.
I can just stop listening to you. It's better than
but
disproving you.
Because
I can just
you know
walk
you
away.
Need to know. You know you need it.
Brock, I got a bunch of draft questions for you, not for Howdy. Let's start with this one. How would your draft change if you have Clowney, if you've signed him or somebody of that value versus if you get to the draft and you still don't have your top end pass rusher?
Well, I don't know where you sit on this a week away from the draft and now, what, 6 weeks or 5 weeks into the new NFL season, Salk, but this was priority one in January, in February, in March. And for me, it remains priority one is to get Jadeveon Clowney signed. So I would sure hope before they go on the clock next Thursday that gets done. So in order to answer that question, let me just first kind of state that declarative statement. That needs to get done because I don't want to go into this draft if I'm the Seahawks with the defensive line on paper that they currently have, sans Jadeveon Clowney or another move. So, you know, much like they were not going to go into last year's draft with four draft picks and they waited and they waited and they played the market beautifully and ended up getting, what, a one and a two for Frank Clark a year ago. I think they're continuing to wait like Braveheart and William Wallace on the line until that clock ticks, until you get near that deadline, until this NFL draft begins. And ultimately, whether it's 2 days before or the day before or the day of, we hear them make a move because on paper, both with their roster, Mike, and on paper with this draft class, as I'm looking at these guys, and I got a bunch of names in front of me as pass rushers and D linemen, you're not going to be a better D line in 2020 than you were in 2019 without a significant move for Clowney or Ngakoue or one of the other franchise guys that is currently tagged that you're going to go trade for.
Okay, but we don't know whether or not they're going to get that done or not. I agree with everything you just said. If they have it done versus if they haven't, how does that change the way you approach the actual draft day?
Well, I don't think it changes their mind all too much, Mike. They have their grades. They have their players. They have they have always been a team that has not been need. Like, we're not going to just draft somebody lesser because we so desperately need that position. So I don't see them changing that after 10 or 11 years of doing these drafts.
Is that true, though? That they're not a draft for need team, because it seems awfully clear to me that every first round pick they've made has been to fill an enormous hole that they've had. Going all the way back to James Carpenter, Jermaine Ifedi, Rashad Penny, Bruce Irvin, they went in with one very specific hole and they picked not the best player available. They picked the best player available at their position of need.
So you think last year with LJ Collier was basically saying what they don't do? You think last year was LJ, we have to get a defensive lineman and we'll take a lesser D lineman there than we will a higher rated.
Just like they did with Carpenter, just like they did with the Fetty,
I don't know if I would agree with that. I think there is something in between there. I think that different positions may have more value to them in a given year and that's part of how you set up your chart. But I don't think they just say, we need a running back and we're going to take who's ever there. I think running back that year might have more value to them than another position does. But I don't think they just draft for need. I don't think they just played lip service to that. I think there's probably something in between.
I think there is some merit to that, Howdy. I will respond. You are the draft. You're not a guru. What are you, expert? You're a draft
expert.
Yes,
I'm a draft insider.
You've studied
every one of
these.
He's a person who likes the draft. He's a draft fan. Yeah. He's a fan of the draft.
Just like Mel Kiper.
I would say that in any given year, and we've heard this for years and years and years, in any given year, how many legit, based on the Seahawks grades, how many legit first round grades do they have on dudes where they're like, yep, these are legit Pro Bowl caliber, however you want to deem it, that they look at it as first round guys. I think John Schneider's even told us, like, any given year, what is it, 13?
Yeah, 15
maybe
to 20.
Maybe upwards of high teens. I don't know if it's ever going to push 20, and I don't know, frankly, if this class does. So once you get beyond, you know, 15 to 20, you're looking at a big grouping of guys that I think they kind of look at very, you know, very similarly, and they put into those different groups by position and look at it. In the year they took Rashad Penny, you know, Chubb was sitting on the board. Lots of running backs were sitting on the board. Lots of guys at other positions. And they were like, yep, this is a guy that we think is going to be an absolute stud and star in our program. We prioritize the run game. So offensive tackles and running backs and blocking tight ends. And, you know, they're going to prioritize prioritize, as Joel Klatt said to us a week ago, right? There are the good organizations that know exactly who they are and how they want to build their team. And they're not wishy-washy, and they don't go and change coaches and change scheme and change philosophy year after year or every 2 years. Well, the Seahawks are one of those. So I think that they prioritize, who did you say, Penny and Carpenter and Fetty. Bruce Irvin, because those guys fit the DNA of big, physical, fast, dominant kind of Seahawk players.
All that being said, if you enter the draft and you don't have Jadeveon Clowney and he's signed somewhere else by then,
I'm going to puke.
Yeah, I mean, well, it doesn't mean that you need to draft a defensive end, but maybe it means you need to trade for a defensive end on draft day.
Yes.
Right? I mean, yes, I guess that's what I'm trying to allude to in the question. Yes. Okay, if you get to the draft and Clowney is gone, and Ngakoue's still out there, and, you know, Howdy just brought up the name Von Miller months ago, and it's stuck in my brain ever since
then.
That's
a tough one now, but go ahead, yeah.
I mean, but somebody like that, are you going into the draft with the view that you're going to try to trade for one of those types of guys and that's going to be a draft day deal? Maybe. It might have to be, and yeah. I guess in that regard, it might change some of your draft strategy. Speaking of Ngakoue, so what is he worth to you what is he worth to you in terms of draft capital and or existing talent on your team?
Right now, with what they have on paper? I mean, this is back to your earlier question about Clowney. Like, if it's not done and you've not made a move there, yeah, that is the most significant need and hole on this roster. When it's in front of me and I'm looking at all these additions and the 15 offensive linemen, Mike, they have under contract and the running backs and the receivers and obviously the QB and even the safeties and the young corners and the corner they traded for. And, you know, their front is there simply is no debate about it, mm-hmm. is to me the most scarce in talent and dynamic splash big time players. So, I guess in some ways, and this is bad, so I'm hesitating to say it, but he's of more value to you than I think a bunch of other teams in this league. So if that means you're going to have to give a first for him, just as the Chiefs valued Frank Clark that way, that they knew Dee Ford was a bit beat up and they let him go and they too had a massive need. And Frank Clark was more valuable to the Chiefs than he was to many others, and thus they gave up the first round pick for him.
So here's the question then. Is Ngakoue a first round pick, a late first round pick, but a first round pick better than Clowney?
I don't think he is to me personally.
That somebody looks at those two players and says he is?
Is it possible they do? Yeah, because he's much, much younger, right? He's got a much healthier frame. He doesn't have the wear and the tear. And ultimately, though, kind of like a very expensive lot, if you buy a very expensive lot on the water, you have got to build a corresponding house in order to pay off that lot. So you're going to trade a first rounder. That's the lot. That's the move. Well, then ultimately you're going to have to then pay him, you know, what, the $18 to $20 million a year that he's looking for over 4 or 5 years to say, yep, this is why we wanted him, because we're going to get him in his prime for the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. Whereas with Clowney, you know, a bunch of those prime years are in the rearview mirror and we're concerned.
They're not that many. I mean, the guy's concerned. Just looking for his first deal or second deal, I guess it is. But I mean, that should still be prime years that you're paying for with Clowney.
It should be, but when you have microfracture surgery on your knee and you've had some of the ailments that he has had over the course of his career, this is not just me saying this. It's not you saying it. It's not the Seahawks saying
it. The league is saying it.
It's what the league is saying. Yep. Yeah, we are scared to give him the mega deal that he has waited for. So we're not going to go that route. And, you know, if the Seahawks make this move, Mike, it would make some sense. This is a team that bets on young a lot, and they would rather go that route and give a guy that, what, is 23, 24 years of age, that doesn't have anywhere near the wear and tear and the significant injuries that Jadeveon has had, and said, okay, you know, we'll go down that road and we'll give him the 4 or 5, you know, year deal and the corresponding 3 years of guaranteed money that largely goes with deals of that size and structure. And I think that's what we're sitting on. I think in the next, you know, 7 or 8 days, much like last year, we were in this position waiting to see what in the world are the Seahawks going to do. Remember that? They had 4 draft picks. Remember John and Tracy sitting with us? like in that room, like, oh, I don't like having four picks. Like, okay, well, something's going to happen. Something has to transpire before this draft begins. And it did. And I think in much the same way, you just look at this huge need for
it. Was the weekend before the draft? Is that when that got done? I know it was over the weekend because I was sitting around listening to one Paul Gallant doing a national show on SB Nation at the time. And he was talking all about it. The deal got done right then.
Yes. Yes. So does the timing of all of what these teams are trying to figure out in this virtual draft world, the headaches of trying to figure out how in the world they're going to do a virtual draft with all these different guys, how in the world the league is going to operate, how many mock virtual drafts can we do? What does that really look like? As all these things are kind of playing out, I think, behind the scenes right now, is that delaying in some ways, you know, the possibility of some of these moves? Or are these guys talking so much that they've got a very clear idea and it's just simply a good old game of chicken in Jacksonville saying, you know what? Look what we did with Jalen Ramsey. We waited and we waited and we waited and people thought we were foolish and it was ugly and it was bad. And then we got two firsts from the LA Rams for Jalen Ramsey. So I think they're waiting and they're trying to play the market and they're playing against a Seahawks front office and group that is as patient as they come in matters like this and has been over the years.
So let me ask you one more broad question because it'll get to eventually some of the players specifically that are going to be in the draft this year for the Seahawks. But before I do it, answer this one for me. Of the two, how many picks did Seahawks make last year? 11?
Yes.
10 are still here? Of the 10 guys that are still here from last year's draft, who can you expect to contribute significantly next year? Take DK Metcalf out of it. Obviously, he's on that list. But who can you reasonably expect to grow in their contribution from last year to this year? Does that make sense?
What? Yeah, I think the most reasonable would be Cody Barton because he got, you know, some of the bigger bites outside of DK. Wouldn't you say he got the most bites of the apple of any of these other guys?
I would, although there's not really a position for him as of right now.
Well, they get one linebacker spot open because they don't have Kendricks back.
And they think they're going to play Bruce Irvin a little bit at that strong side linebacker in early downs and then as a pass rusher, you know, in other downs and how much, you know, they're going to limit that. So he's kind of in a head-on collision course with Bruce Irvin to compete for that strong side linebacker spot.
So you expect more from him?
Yep.
Ugo
Amadi. It's the guys at the top, Mike. Look at this draft capital. It's 29 and 47. Right? The 29th pick in last year's draft was LJ Collier, the 47th pick and the second highest safety in 10 years that this team ever drafted behind Earl Thomas was Marquise Blair. And those guys were largely on a bad defense. And I'm sorry to say that, but when you're in the bottom five rush defense.
But hold on, that's not my question. The question isn't what did they do last year? That's in the past. Yep. What can I reasonably expect each of them to do this year? Because that's going to affect the way I approach the draft. Is Marquise Blair going to compete and actually potentially win one of your two starting safety jobs? Is LJ Collier going to be a five technique who gets regular playing time in 2020? Or are those pipe dreams? Because that's going to affect the way I attack my draft this year. If I believe those, is Ugo Amadi going to be the leader in the clubhouse to be the nickel corner on this team? Or is it another year of kind of, you know, hoping and praying at that position that somebody works out? I mean, you got to answer some of those questions for me in terms of, and I know you don't have to give me a solid, this will happen, but what's a reasonable assumption to make if I'm John Schneider heading into the draft?
The reasonable assumption is we use every one of these drafts to build because we know in this NFL, we want to be young. Right? This is how we are going to build our team. We want to be a young team. Pete wants to play young guys. We want to give him lots of fuel. We have lots of volume in these drafts and have 11 picks last year because we want to be a young team. And while many of them did not contribute significantly as rookies, it is absolutely go time for Marquise Blair to beat out Bradley McDougald, to pair him with a veteran guy they brought in Diggs, who should continue to grow him and elevate him and teach him and lead him and be on the field together. He should absolutely be the starting safety next year. He runs a 4-4. He is a head hunter. He is violent. He is physical. He's all those things that we drafted him at number 47 in that draft last year. And paired with Quandre Diggs' skill set, that is the group that I want moving forward. That should absolutely be the reasonable expectation. Bradley McDougald is older. He is slower. He's an excellent third safety. But, you know, if you're going to be a Super Bowl winning team, and you're going to beat the 49ers, and you're going to beat the Rams, and you're going to win in the NFC, you need a guy like Marquise Blair back there being the headhunter and the violent guy.
Is Ugo Amadi going to be my nickel corner this year?
Yes.
Okay, then I'm done in the secondary, right? I don't
need
to spend major capital.
This is not a great safety class, by the way.
Well, even the whole secondary. I don't need a corner. I don't need a safety. If you're telling me that those five guys, you know, that those two specifically are going to elevate, you've made a big deal for a cornerback. You still have Shaquille Griffin. I'm not saying that you don't find somebody later in the draft to help depth at that position. But you're telling me that the entire secondary, and really you're telling me linebacker, because you believe Cody Barton is good enough, you're telling me I don't need to worry about those two positions.
I would say linebacker would be priority for me ahead of secondary, because KJ, to me, even though very productive a year ago, was still beat up, and that knee is another year older.
You drafted two linebackers last year, right?
Yes. So Ben Burkervin and Cody Barton, are those game-changing, win a Super Bowl, defeat people in this league and in your division kind of guys? I don't feel great about that. I think is a fifth-round pick with BBK. He's a excellent and should be and could be a captain of your special teams the next couple years. And that's some of the role in a backup that could be a spot starter. Cody Barton, to be determined. There were certainly things that I liked. And as a rookie, the game was not too big for him. Is he physically at a point where some of these guys in this draft could be in the second or third round? Especially in the second round with one of those picks, when I look at, I don't know, a Troy Dye or a Willie Guy out of Mississippi State, you know, two guys that can really run and are bigger and even more physical than Cody. So I would not rule out linebacker, mostly because of the age of Bruce Irvin and also the age of KJ Wright. I think, yes, Mike, I would make that assertion based on our conversation that corner should not and safety should not be prioritized in the first four rounds or five rounds of this draft.
But linebacker is still a spot that you would consider.
I think that's
probably not in the first two rounds, though, right? I mean, you got enough holes on this team.
Probably not. But yeah, I those are definitely on the back burner. The enormous void is up front on that defensive line.
And so I got to ask you then, before we start naming players, what's a reasonable expectation for LJ Collier next year?
Ooh, he's got to play more than 170 snaps. I mean, he's got to be a rotate. He has to be as a 29th pick in the draft. He has got to be a rotational guy that when he comes in actually shows up on a stat sheet. He actually makes a difference. He actually was what Brian Baldinger raved about in his film study, is a guy that ripped through people, that dominated at the point of attack, that played with so much more urgency and suddenness and power than he ever displayed in any snaps a season ago. Right? So a reasonable, I can't say he's going to start, he's going to own it, and he's going to get you six sacks, Mike. I can't do that reasonably because I didn't see anything near that a season ago that makes me feel
good. Here's what I don't feel like we saw last year, and I think we need to. And this is a Pete Carroll quote from right after the draft last year about LJ Collier. And tell me if you saw, I mean, look, I don't know how much we would have, but this is from Pete. "We think we've really got something really special in him." That's two reallys, by the way, for Pete. "I fell in love with the fact that he's got a big chip in his shoulder and he wants to prove it and all that." Did we see any of that chip last year?
No.
I think that's the thing that just bummed me out about Collier. And maybe I wouldn't have seen it. Maybe that's the type of stuff that shows up in practice and, you know, he didn't get enough time in a game. But the one thing I think I expected to see, maybe the technique wouldn't be great, but I guess I just expected that some of that edge and attitude and chip on the shoulder was going to show up and was going to be talked about and was going to be part of the story on LJ Collier last year. And the only reason that I'm worried about him, and by the way, I do think he'll be better this year than he was last year. I think he'll end up being something for them. Where was the chip on the shoulder?
Well, it was shelved. I think that chip was in his ankle. And as far as that goes, I'll give him a little bit of the benefit.
That's true.
He
did get hurt early, right?
He got hurt early and missed all of training camp. So I will give him a little benefit of the doubt that injury didn't affect him, to me, like week 10, as far as his health and his power and his speed or any of that stuff. But I will give him the benefit of the doubt that when you chip, you know, a bone in your ankle, basically, with a high ankle sprain, and you get everything knocked out in that way and you're on the sidelines, that, yeah, I think displaying some of that in training camp,
especially
Mike,
at
which
that position.
Where, Yes, especially at that position and especially in preseason games where your motor can run and you can start to feel it and you can play your butt off and you're actually having success in the preseason because you're playing against slappy second and third team O-linemen. And, you know, you just start to feel some of that confidence go and some of, you know, some of that rev and just, you know, production. And he had none of that. By the time he played and was thrown in the mix, he's going up against the ones. He's going up against guys that were so much better than what he faced in the Big 12. And he ate a big slice of humble pie a bunch.
I'm going to assume that, look, I don't know whether there's going to be a training camp and everything else that we normally would expect to have. But if this football season is able to start as we would expect it to in August like that, I guess my assumption is that he's somebody we're going to be able to tell about right away. That the kind of training camp he has will dictate the kind of season he has. And if he comes in out for blood and tearing guys up in training camp and angry and chipping the shoulder and pushing guys around and trying to be a bully and all that, you know, playing the Mike Bennett role from a few years ago, that'll be a pretty good harbinger of things to come. And if it doesn't happen and he's quiet in training camp, then maybe you got a real big problem with your LJ Collier pick from a year ago.
And I will say one more thing. I'll add one more little nugget to that is you're going to have an easy tell by the shape he comes in. Right. These guys, you know, have had very little contact. Will continue, I think, to have very little contact. We'll see, you know, as they start to now be able to at least virtually get workouts and do some things. But places have been shut down. So who's had that chip on their shoulder over the last 2.5 months to work? Who's going to come in when we see him like, oh, gosh, that's too bad. Ooh, we put on 15 pounds. And oh, there's the strained hamstring or the strained calf that comes right with that.
We're
added weight.
Alvin Bailey this time.
Oh,
350 bones.
Just keeps eating his way right back to it. All right, Brock, I'm going to ask you to give me some names. You're ready? Some draft names. I'm going to give you attributes, and you're going to tell me guys that will help with that. Does that make sense?
Okay.
I'm going to give you some things that NFL teams want on their team, or NFL GMs want. You tell me some guys that the Seahawks could have interest in that will help them improve it. So let's start with speed. Who could they draft to make this team faster?
KJ Hamler. Wide receiver, Penn State, 5'9", 178, is arguably, to my eye, when I saw him in person and when I watched tape and I watch him on TV, is just faster than everybody else. And for a team that, you know, wants to play defense and run the ball, you got to be good on special teams. And, you know, early in, you know, they traded for Percy Harvin to be a kick returner and a slot receiver and be faster than everybody else. KJ Hamler is little. He's 5'9". He's 178. He didn't run at the combine and Penn State's pro day got knocked out. So there's not an official. Their internal numbers have him high 4'2", low 4'3" kind of guy. And that speed translates on the field. So as far as if you want a slot to go with, Tyler Lockett and to go with DK Metcalf. And I know you drafted or you signed Philip Dorsett to a 1-year deal, but if you want a guy that may be in the third round, if he's still hanging around in this unbelievably deep wide receiver class, that dude is lightning in a bottle. And then the other name, similarly,
before you move on, let me just ask you two questions on him. One, is that a Tyreek Hill type of guy? Is that what you're looking at there? Somebody
he's not
that
as
role?
Thick. Tyreek Hill is just a muscle ball of explosion, but he's that kind of fast. He's little. He's 5'9 at 178. He's not, you know, thick and Devin Duvernay, the kid out of Texas who I've told you before, who's an absolute jerk on the field, who's mean as hell. He's 5'11, he's 200. He was a world class track guy in high school and in the state of Texas, and he transitioned from an outside receiver into a slot and was one of the most productive in all of college football a year ago. He would be another guy that would probably, I wouldn't say again Tyreek Hill, because that guy is just
he's
in a class
obviously.
Of his own.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, but as far as just, you know, straight speed, that it's stunning to your eye when you see it in person. I put Hamler one, and I put Devin Duvernay out of Texas on that list
as
well.
If you're going after slot receivers to help speed, do you want Tyler Lockett playing more outside?
Yeah, I love Tyler Lockett out at flanker. I loved his big plays before he got injured last year, right? And they moved him all around. I absolutely love what he's capable of doing on the outside with DK at split end and Tyler at flanker. And then you put a weapon like that, sure. Now, they went Dorsett probably to play a little more outside and let Tyler get into the slot and such. But if you're in the third round and you want just speed, like you want an instantaneous speed upgrade to your special teams as well, KJ Hamler is, and Devin Duvernay for that matter, 1 and 1A as far as explosion.
Are there other guys, and maybe they're not off the top of your head, who would help team speed, not necessarily at a speed position? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, you bring up wide receivers. Obviously, that's a place where speed is a natural fit. Are there defensive ends, defensive tackles, linebackers? You're probably not
I would say not as fast in the secondary this year at corner. The receivers are by far, in a way, you know, the class of this draft when it comes to just freaky athletes and speed. D tackle would be the other one that's got some straight anomalies and outliers. Neville Gallimore is a guy that you've seen mocked. He's out of Oklahoma. He was one of Bruce Feldman's freaks. He's 300 pounds and he ran 4.73 at the combine. I saw him 10 times in college, and every time I was intrigued, and I was like, oh my gosh, this guy is just a freaky athlete, but he never took over games. I would say Justin Matabuike out of A&M, and actually I was texting Uncle Luke about him. Phenomenal talent, you know, 6'3", 293 D tackle, running 4.83 at the combine. So those two guys, you know, they're not, you know, where our boy out of LA is with the Rams as far as 280 pounds running 4.5, like Pete always loves to always reference Aaron Donald. But these are two 290, 305. I mean, these are big dudes running freaky, freaky fast at D tackle. That's probably where the next position of just having an outlier for speed would come.
Well, it's a good lead into the next one, which is size. If you're looking to get bigger, where are you looking to add size?
Yeah, I'll give you a few names. And again, these are guys that I've seen, and I'm probably a little biased in that way, but Leki Fotu out of Utah, and that's a program that this program in Seattle with the draft last year of a couple of Utes loves because they're physical, because they're ornery, because you know what you're getting in Kyle Whittingham. And Leki Fotu is 6'6", 330 pounds, unbelievable snap and bend. Not as much like just game and why maybe he was projected as a first rounder before the season and is going to fall somewhere in the second or third round because he's not, you know, Haloti Ngata as far as like just overall game or even, you know, some of the others we've seen at that position, but pure size that you want to put in the interior of your defensive line and change the space dynamic and not give up 5 yards to carry. Leki Fotu is a guy I'm probably a little biased of, but I loved his game at Utah and just the force and the role that he plays.
It is interesting how, I mean, we talk about DK Metcalf with the speed, but really the size is almost as big a deal, right? And the way he sort of changes with that. I'm always intrigued by qualities at a position where they're not necessarily the number one, right? Like wide receiver speed. Okay, fine. But wide receiver who's also got like some of that mammoth size, so interesting. Why is Aaron Donald so good? Obviously, he's freakish strong, but isn't it his speed that really sets him apart as a defensive tackle and not just mammoth strength? I mean, you can find pluggers. When you can find speed at that position, it's so much more interesting. When you can find a linebacker or something with speed or, I don't know, just somebody who's a, you know, why is Cam Chancellor so interesting? He was a safety with crazy size, right?
Well, you're speaking Pete Carroll's language.
I love that stuff.
I mean, that's why Pete loved five-star dudes.
They're guys that stand out.
Yes. Yeah, and you know, why he had DeSean Jackson and those guys back in the day at USC in their summer camps, you know, running on grass in cleats after practice, not beforehand in track shoes on the track. Like, he wanted the football-fast dudes and the really elite. Okay, what is that elite skill set? How many times have we heard that over the years? KJ Wright has elite length at 6'5", playing linebacker. Bobby Wagner, 250, has elite twitch and speed. Richard Sherman at 6'3", you know, had elite 4.45 athleticism and a triple jumper. Right? I mean, we just kind of go through this list, and that's why Leki Fotu at 6'6" and 330 has elite bend. It's a martial arts guy, right? A judo guy, you know, just a elite bend. And an elite power for that kind of size. KJ Hamler is little, but you know, when you run high 4.2s handheld and low 4.3s, you're just a different speed than everybody else. And yeah, I think that's always intriguing to Pete and John and where they're oftentimes aligned.
Find me a young player in this draft who can increase the playmaking on this team, who will just cause turnover, score touchdown, 50-yard touchdowns. Give me somebody or a couple of guys that will improve your playmaking.
Well, I would again say they probably lean a little more in this draft, Mike, on the offensive side. At running back, the Jonathan Taylor 4.38 Wisconsin running back, the A.J. Dillon, the 250-pound absolute bulldozer with low 4.5 speed out of, running back out of Boston College. J.K. Dobbins, we saw at Ohio State, just shred records and is an all-around running back. Those are kind of the running back guys. I gave you a few of the wide receivers. That list goes 10 deep. I would say defensively, just a playmaker, and he's going to be gone. And your expert there that you're sitting by in the room will tell you that Grant Delpit out of LSU is a 6'3", 212-pound, ball-hawking, Jim Thorpe Award-winning, just, knocks the ball away, takes the ball away, forces the ball away.
Major recruit, has been great his entire career. Maybe not the elite athleticism, but he's always around the ball.
And, most of those mocks, where have you seen him? He's been in the
20s. He goes anywhere between 21 and 40. So correct. He may be right there. But, again, that's your least position of need. But he is a true difference maker, playmaker type.
Don't love the corners, Mike, in this draft for that purpose, other than the elite top guys, Okuda from Ohio State, that are going to be gone before you ever draft. So into the 20s and 40s and 60s at corner, I would say not terrific. It's safety behind Delpit. I would say necessarily not terrific in that way.
Linebacker.
If
you want to spend a first round pick on a linebacker, there's a few options, but
there are. Kenneth Murray is a guy. You heard Joel Klatt mention him a week ago. Joel saw him a bunch at Oklahoma. I saw Oklahoma way too many times, and defensively they were so bad over the last 3 years, took some steps this year and then fell off the cliff again. And he looks the part. I mean, he's a beautiful looking athlete, but I don't know if I would say, oh yeah, absolutely, that guy is a ball hawk and just a game changer and a playmaker. More of them to me fall at the receiver and the running back position in this draft class.
All right, what if you need to add some violence to your team? Just good old fashioned Molyneux violence. Find me some violent young players.
Yeah, I like Bradley Anae out of Utah, the defensive end, and he's probably third round pick. We'll see. Again, did not test great, ran a 4.940 and only jumped 31 inches, but he's 6'3", 257, and the dude is just violent and has a bunch of snap and will absolutely knock your block off. Chaseon, the LSU defensive end. What's that?
Getting Chase Young again?
The one that Mike always will think is Chase Young. Every time it's mentioned, oh, Chase Young.
Chase
yeah,
Young,
that guy.
I've heard of him. Let's
he's
go.
Great. Let's
we should get
him.
Chase Young.
Yeah.
Chaseon Young.
I love it.
He's an interesting guy because you're seeing in mocks, he's anywhere from 15 to kind of mid 20s, but he's 6'3", he's 254. Think Cliff Averill plus as far as just athleticism and speed and burst. And when you play at LSU, man, you're going to be a violent guy. There's a couple offensive linemen I like in that mold. There's a massive, absolutely, you said earlier about massive. Isaiah Wilson at Georgia is 6'7", 350 pounds. He's a redshirt sophomore, only 3 years in school. He played tackle there. He's not a tackle. He is a guard. He is a Roger from Tacoma guard in the NFL that is 6'7", 350, but it's actually somehow still pieced together and looks good. It's not like, ooh, there's a lot of parts there to get to that kind of mass and size. Big time recruit, actually out of Brooklyn, New York, that ended up at Georgia, has started there as a tackle the last 2 years, but is a massive human being. Another absolutely massive guard is out of Michigan, Michael Onwenu, and he's probably a fifth or sixth rounder, but he's 6'3", and he's 350 pounds, and those dudes played in systems where you didn't have to project like you did with, many of Tom Cable's guys because they never put their hand in the ground. When you play at Georgia, when you play at Michigan, when you play at LSU, when you play at those schools, you know what it's like to play with pad level and leverage and lean into people and want and seek that violence and physical contact.
What about John Simpson? I like that guy. Out of Clemson?
Yes, is he a Georgia boy too?
He's a Clemson dude. Real
He's
big
Clemson.
Guy.
He is a big dude, yeah. And there's more, all the five tackles are going to be gone before the Seahawks draft in the 20s. There's a bunch of offensive tackles that are that would add that level of violence to Mike, they're all going to be gone by the time you're around at 27. But there are some guards and some middle round dudes. Yeah, I don't know, man. It's weird, and I don't want to have a bias because each year is unique. And the fact that the Seahawks drafted two guys from Utah a year ago, and you know, you made fun of me with Harold Landry. You don't take a DN from Boston College, and you don't take a right in some of that natural, rightfully so, bias you have with some guys. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say, oh man, you drafted Marquise Blair and Cody Barton in the second and third round, therefore you should not draft Bradley and I and Lecky Fotu. But you know, when you appreciate and respect the toughness and the hard edge in that program, and
but
what
also
guys
you don't
want to
just be Utah.
No, you don't want to be, but I mean, Utah's pretty dang good the last couple years.
They're okay. They're in the Pac-12. They're only can be so good.
Did you see what their quarterback is? Come on, they got no offense.
They're on the Pac-12. No, you can only be so good. You're in the Pac-12.
Yeah.
What do you want in my life, man? How good could they possibly be?
They're blue-collar guys, man. What do you want?
That's fine, but if they were really good, they wouldn't be in the Pac-12, or at the very least, they'd be winning the Pac-12.
That's why they're not first-round picks.
Well, they should win the Pac-12 if all those guys are that good, right?
I'll give you another
random
guy.
Also, the guys you got from Utah last year should be good.
I'll give you
another
kind of...
We shouldn't be debating whether or not Cody Barton's maybe going to contribute this year, and same with Marquise Blair. You're going to be like, yeah, those two guys you got from Utah last year, they're awesome. They're living up to their billing instead of being like... we'll see.
Well, I don't think I ever in last year's draft class, you can correct me if I'm wrong, you can call me out, but I don't think when it came to Cody Barton or Ben Burkervin, I was like, oh yeah, violent dudes. Cody Barton, I liked, you know, I thought he was a pretty versatile player.
Until you saw
but
his
I didn't
picture.
Think I didn't think he was just like, oh my gosh, he's gonna, you know, knock your socks off. And he wasn't the guy at Utah doing it. Marquise Blair was. He was a guy whose violence I absolutely loved, and for some reason, he just never gained the trust of Pete and the secondary people and Ken Norton in year number one. I still think he's a violent guy, and I would put Lecky Fotu and Bradley and I much more violent than I would Cody Barton or Ben Burkervin or Ugo Amadi or any or DeMarcus Merry Christmas, any of those guys they drafted a season ago on that side of the ball.
Where is that guy? Is he going to play this year?
DeMarcus Merry Christmas?
Yeah.
I believe he's still on the roster. Yeah, I think he was. Yeah. I think he was on IR last year.
He's the guy
I
kept calling Deontay Christmas, though.
Yeah,
right?
Pretty much.
That was the guy who played at Syracuse. He's a basketball player.
Let me give you one. One more.
He's gonna
and I don't know where Jabari Zuniga is.
Rusher out of Florida.
Where is he in your mock 81 mock draft?
When this thing started 3 months ago, he was a second round pick, and now he's somewhere between the late third and mid fifth.
Yeah, he would be another, if you were just to say, hey, give me a violent guy, Brock, that you saw over the years in college football, he'd be another one that I would add to the list. 6'3", 264. You remember the bust from a year ago, the pass rusher that was like or 2 years ago out of Florida, maybe it was even last year. Oh, gosh, I'm blanking on his name. And people loved him, and he was flashy, but he played on third downs at Florida. I'm like, this guy is soft. He just has no snap, no violence, no physical nature. It's the end on the other side. This guy, Jabari, that was the one that was by far the most violent. At 6'3", 264 with some measurables, you know, keep an eye on him. So I guess I'll kind of wrap up because these names get lost, but I'll wrap it up this way. Outside of Chaisson and maybe Gross Matos, the guy out of Penn State, 6'5", 266, those are kind of the upper crust that could still be there in the mid-20s for you. Outside of that, I'm right lockstep with you, Mike. I want violent. I want somebody I don't need to see any more Brandon Jacksons or Rasheem Greens or these guys that I never saw as violent dudes in college.
I want Frank Clark's.
Yes, give me somebody
Frank Clark
with some
is violent.
Snap. Give me somebody that when he hits, their head snaps back, and that's Bradley and I, and that's Jabari Zuniga out of Florida. Give me those guys. Give me somebody who I have seen in person that I know has that kind of just physical snap. And, you know, I've seen who's the other kid?
Aquara.
Again, I saw him in Notre Dame. Is he prettier? Yeah. He's 6'4". He's 250. He jumps 35 inches. But I don't see the violence. And this defense needs violence. So there's some mid-round defensive ends there for you, Salk, out of Utah and Florida. Keep an eye on of guys that I like that are violent.
All right, we're going to finish up here in a few minutes, Brock, with some which is better. I got to tell you, I am missing baseball. I really am. It's the nice weather and all that. We'll talk more, but I'm missing baseball. And so when Passan comes out, what, a week ago with that whole potential plan and the Arizona plan and then later the Arizona-Florida plan, I can't help the fact that my first reaction is like, really? like Wendell when we like go to take out his food from the fridge and he knows there's a chance that he's going to get fed. That's my reaction. Like, I can't help it. I start drooling a little bit and walk right over.
You're seeing it in Taiwan. I mean, Taiwan, I believe, is the first, and they're considering it in Japan as well, right? With nobody in the stands, you know, kind of with fake people in the stands. But you are at least starting to see those leagues.
What did you just say?
Play ball.
How are you going to put fake people
out
there?
What do you mean, fake people?
They're going to be just like AI?
No.
The placards. They put fake, like looking like people in the stands.
You serious? Like mannequins?
Yes. Like cardboard cutouts.
They put fat heads all up in the stands.
They put cardboard cutouts.
I mean, I guess all the retail stores aren't using their mannequins. Just throw them out in the stands.
Too.
Why not?
Yes. No, they're doing that.
I mean, none of them have heads, but other than that, you get
got cardboard cutouts in the stands.
Interesting.
You know, to try to make it look a little better for the TV angle of it, but they are playing baseball.
Are they pumping in crowd noise?
I would think so.
You might as well at that point.
Yes.
Here's a couple of things. Look, if baseball comes back, I won't be able to be upset about that. It will just make me happy to have baseball. But it won't be right. I honestly do believe it. It won't be right if baseball comes back before school starts again, before people get back to work, regular people, not pro athletes. If baseball comes back before everything else restarts, that doesn't seem quite right. There's 17 million plus people who are out of work right now. And for us to go to those lengths to get baseball back, I don't know, man. It'd be really hard for me to justify the wealthy players, the super wealthy owners, all getting to get back to work before everybody else. That doesn't seem right.
Well, it'd be really hard for me to believe, Mike, that that's going to happen. Like, you're going to have the first steps of opening up the economy, of opening up those stadiums and those ballparks and the workers. And we talked about the television people. Like, it can't just be those and those players and those players alone.
I hope not. I hope that's not what baseball's thinking is going to happen. Because, look, I'll watch it anyway. I really will. I will be offended by the idea, but it won't stop me from watching it. I want to be clear. I love baseball. And if it's on, I'm going to watch. There's nothing else going on. Yeah. Right? I mean, like, I'm going to watch it, but, you know, the moral part of me is going to be like, you know, it doesn't feel right. Like, they shouldn't be doing this while 17 million people have found themselves out of work and a lot more potentially going to come. So, that being said, we're a sports show, not a restart the economy show. So, if they do it, I will watch, and I do love some of the ideas. I love the idea of different divisions based on spring training. Like, how fun would that be to see the Mariners with the Royals and the Padres and the Brewers? Like, that'd be a blast, wouldn't it?
For one time, for one season.
That's awesome.
Yeah, you're going to call this season a wild card anyways. You're just going to say, look, everything here that happened is weird. It exists and it's real and we're going to count it. But it was weird. So let's go to the full max and let's do all sorts of fun stuff.
I'm all in on that. I think that would be a really fun way to do it. I like most of the rule proposals that they've had. I mean, the idea of 7-inning doubleheaders.
So cool.
Who's saying no to that?
That should be a league mandated requirement.
Do like 10 of those a year.
You play 5 days a week, and one day is a doubleheader to 2 7-inning games.
Absolutely. They do that in AAA. It's great. They do it in the minors. It's awesome. I mean, I've been
doing it in 112 degree heat, and then either in Arizona or the heat.
They get paid millions of dollars, Brock. Don't give me your bleeding hearts about these millionaires.
You know, the heat thing is actually a legit concern that we need to talk about a little bit as part of this. But I do love the idea of twins, you know, 7-inning doubleheaders. I like the idea of no mound visits, although I think the relievers are going to like die. I mean, those guys are the fifth starters, the guys who don't really have the mental toughness to handle what they're doing anyway. Sending those guys out there with no ability for the catcher or the pitching coach to come out and talk to them, that's a huge hindrance. And I think you're going to expose some guys, which is, I think, very entertaining. It also seems a little challenging for the language barriers that exist in baseball that sometimes you can make up for by coming up and talking in person, right up close. You know, and I don't just mean, you know, guys who speak Spanish. You got Japanese speaking guys and Korean speaking guys and English speaking guys, people from the South and nobody can understand. I mean, like, there's a lot of different people in baseball.
Hold on.
We are, as you said earlier.
Remember Roy Cochran? Couldn't understand anything that guy said.
we're not going to argue the merits in the timing of when to reopen the economy. That's not, that's, you know, we're a sports show, as you said. We're a sports podcast.
Yeah, Brock,
what's your gut and your hunch? Do you think we're going to have this summer? Do you think the baseball and the players and the player association and the owners and everybody involved and knowing the way that league operates, do you think they will be the first to be able to operate either in Arizona or in Florida and will actually make these things happen?
Here's the thing. I don't think we're going to get baseball, and I don't think we're going to get football. So, I'm probably on the other side of what I think is going to happen. But the greed of baseball and football owners is such a wild card. It's such a powerful force that I don't know how to bet against it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I guess my question would be,
baseball's going to lose $3 billion by not being on this year.
Already in other countries in their leagues.
Yeah.
Is it just the greedy Taiwanese league? Is it just the greedy Japanese league? Or is that solely on greed? Or obviously it hit there.
Talking about very different situations, smaller countries. I mean, completely. I don't know that it's fair to compare. I don't think it's going to happen based on kind of just what we've seen and the mood and everything else. I don't know. Maybe the whole Arizona Florida plan will work out. I don't see it working out any other way in baseball this year. I don't see any way they're playing in all 30 cities, right? That's not going to happen. Or 28 cities, right? Or 26 cities, I guess. But like that's not going to happen. I have concerns that the NFL will be able to get it done in all of the cities that they're in. Right, they're in what, 30 cities? I think it would be really challenging for the NFL to get all of them on board and ready and at a place where everyone feels comfortable. I think some of these other things work because of some geographic limiting, right? I don't know.
I guess the challenge is we're about 30 days into this or so, roughly, right? Maybe 35 days
into
this. And what's that?
I feel like we've been doing this for a year and a half.
That's right.
It feels it's been going on forever.
Correct. But it's been, about 30 to 35 days, and we have seen so much and learned so much, and the data has changed so much in 30, 35 days. How do you know what the next 30 or the next 60 or the next 90 or the next football season? It's 120-some days out.
As you said, you asked me to take a wild guess.
Yeah.
I guess that's what I think. Here's one thing I would do if I'm the Mariners, and I wonder if this could help them. It seems like the Mariners have wanted to sign Jared Kelnick to a long-term deal before he even gets to the majors, right? We've kind of had some of this conversation back and forth about what that would mean for them, and could they then start him right in the big leagues to begin this year, et cetera. They believe in him long-term. They'd like to lock him up on an Evan White kind of deal before he even gets to the majors. Fine. Kelnick probably wasn't interested in that, and we've sort of said, like, he's a guy who wants to bet on himself, and maybe he doesn't. Okay, fine. Does this change? If you're Jared Kelnick, and you got to put yourself in his skin, would this make you in any way more willing to sign a deal? I think I could argue it would. And as much as I know he's a guy who wants to bet on himself, that may not be what the bet's on. The bet may be on the economy. The bet may be on what's going to happen with salaries and CBA. And if $3 billion is lost or even some huge portion of that, is that going to find itself in?
Correct.
If I'm Jared Kelnick, yeah. I want as much security as I can get.
Yeah,
and I'm probably signing something early in order to get that done.
It's pretty fascinating and I'm curious if either side is talking. Like, I wonder if the Mariners on their side are like,
I'd be reaching out to him. Absolutely,
yeah,
I would be.
Or, you know what, let's just kind of see how the dust settles here, and let's see what this next CBA is, and let's see exactly what the economic climate is.
I want that guy locked in, man. I want Jared Kelnick. If you truly believe in that, I want him locked in. Kelnick, I think on his side, would be thinking either, yeah, I want security. I don't know what's going to happen with the CBA down the road. I want to be very secure. Or he's thinking, I don't want to negotiate in the middle of a pandemic.
Correct.
This is the worst possible time to negotiate. Yep. I want to wait maybe till the global pandemic ends, and then we'll see where we're at. The problem, I think, for baseball is things may be worse off. And if, he may be costing himself millions in that regard, why not take some real security, know that you're going to be set for years, and then take your chances down the road?
So you'd make that call if you're Jerry and Kevin and crew with the Mariners.
You'd
be wanting to negotiate in the middle.
Yeah, I think I would. Especially with him, I would love to try to get this thing done long term. We'll see what happens. Brock, you know what that sound is? Time for
let's
which is better?
Deal.
No, it's not. Let's make a deal. What's the matter with you? It's which
the
is
boys
better?
Are back again. The boys are back in town.
Oh, man. That was like, that was what, 6 years ago now?
The boys are back in town.
That's the actual words. You came in and said the boys are back again.
The boys are back again. The boys are back again.
And Lizzie. I feel bad for them. All right, you ready for some which is better questions? I got a bunch. I got a bunch of which is better questions for the quarantiner.
Did you like mine? I threw your way too.
Yeah, I've got a few. I got a few years in here as well.
Oh, good.
All right. Which is better? Quarantine with sunny, warm weather or quarantine with cold, rainy weather? Which is better?
I mean, for me, it's by far the sunshine and just getting stuff done around the house and walking. And Molly and I have had like the longest walks and talks we've ever had in our marriage in 20, coming up on 21 years. So I don't think we'd be walking and talking in the rain, in the gloom, in the cold, in the wind. We'd be napping and nesting and napping and eating and napping. So I'm going to say the sunshine.
I think there's a trick question here, to be honest with you, because the answer is everything's better with warm sunshine. Doesn't matter if it's a quarantine or anything else. When the weather is nice, life is better. I don't care what else is going on. But
yep,
it is more, it's a little more torturous. It's more frustrating being at home with the warm weather. Like that nesting, couch, napping, cold weather, like, dude, it stinks out. I'm stuck inside. Fine. Like this is sort of what this weather is made for. So when it's cold and nasty, it's like, yeah, all right. I don't mind just doing nothing. But when it's warm and sunny and beautiful, yeah, you can get outside a little bit. But it just feels like you're missing out. You're missing out on grilling with your friends or going places, road trip. I mean, there's so many things. Golf. I mean, there's so many great things about warm weather around here. The fact that we're going to have like the nicest April on record, none of us can go out and enjoy it. Yeah. It's just, you can't write it.
Come on. We got to open up the golf and the fishing.
We got to open up the golf.
Come on.
We have to.
Well, you can't even have mound visits when baseball comes back. Like golf?
They're playing golf in Oregon.
No way.
Which is better? You Shook Me All Night Long or Back in Black? Two songs, same album, mammoth hits. Crossed over into the pop realm. Which is better? You Shook Me All Night Long or Back in Black?
I love Black and Back in Black. I love it.
I do too. I probably unfairly, and I've been listening to a lot of hair metal music and rock music working out, as have kids actually. So I'm going to lean just a little bit to Back in Black because I think it's better in the white room.
It's definitely better. You Shook Me All Night Long is like the worst AC/DC song. This is an easy one. Which do you think has more listens on Spotify?
You Shook Me All Night Long.
No, it's Back in Black. About 550 million to 380 million.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Good.
Who knew? Which is better, Pete Carroll or Steve Kerr? They're hosting a podcast together, right?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Who's better? Steve Kerr's got like a lot of rings, right?
Yeah.
He's got a bunch as a player, bunch as a coach.
Yeah.
Steve Kerr's better, right?
I think so. I think Steve Kerr is better. But he's got
an
easier road.
He's having a good year this year. I mean, take away the players, he's really doing some great things.
Is that true?
No.
Oh.
No.
What was their record this year?
They're terrible. They're like
worse than the league. It's the NBA.
Yes. And they're trying to have a dumpy
season. But he managed to get all those players together and get them to play like that.
And it's not like he had like LeBron James and Kevin Durant at the same time. Like, Steph Curry is good, but he's not like the guy who changes everything all the time. He's a great shooter, and he's a great facilitator, and he's amazing. He's one of the 10 best players in the league.
I'm going to say Coach Carroll. I think Kerr's a little more divisive. He's a little feistier. He's more public. And
You're right. Everyone agrees that Pete Carroll's great. You're right. He's not polarizing or divisive at all.
No, well, you said
what
Kerr.
What are you
I'm
talking
gonna go,
about?
I'm going to go Pete.
But that's not a good reason.
Yes,
it
is.
You can take Pete, but it's not because he's not divisive.
Pete Carroll is not out there as much as Kerr is, in, you know, politically. He's not tweeting those things. And he will mention it here. You think he is? You think Pete Carroll
he
is out there?
He finds a way to get himself
much?
Out there, yes.
What's that?
He gets himself out there.
Not as much as Kerr does. Not as divisively as Kerr does.
It is true.
Not as often. But when he does, he goes big. Go big or go home, man. Chunk plays. He likes those chunk plays, man. Not a volume
he
shooter.
He does. And Pete was also just a, look at his nose. I mean, the guy broke his nose how many times? Just as a head-hunting safety back there. So I'm going to give the lean to Petey on that one.
Which is better, watering the lawn or mowing and edging the lawn? Easy, watering. All you do is click on the sprinklers and walk away.
If that's the case, I'm in.
Easiest answer ever.
No. I'm not talking. No, I'm not talking that one right now. I'm talking. We had some new sod put down a couple weeks ago.
Oh, wait, yes. What?
Yes.
During the quarantine?
It's essential, man.
Essential sod?
Yes.
The old
you
grass.
You may not want to admit this.
The old grass was, I made sure they can work and, right. But the old front yard was just mossy and dead and infected. And I just said, enough with it. Just tear it out and put like new sod in, like the new rolls. And it was amazing how they were able to do that, how quickly they were able to do that. And it wasn't near as expensive as I thought it would be. So I'm out there and they can't mow it. And I don't really want the whole sprinklers on quite yet. I think we're getting close to turning them on. And to water a lawn with the hose is super fulfilling and rewarding. It's like, and you see the thing done. I can understand why the grounds crew's out there still in Safeco Field, watering the dirt and at times hand watering the grass.
I got to tell you, man, I like after my lawn is mowed because I like the way it looks and it's clean yes. and all that. But neither thing is, both things are awful.
Terrible. Eh?
I hate mowing. I can't stand
it. It's so bad. I've thought legitimately about springing for a robot lawnmower.
Like a Roomba?
Yeah, but it does your lawn.
I mean, you could just
they
pay
have those.
To, you just pay somebody to come
no,
mow
no,
your
no,
lawn.
No, I need a robot to do it.
they have those mowers.
I know. I've thought about getting one.
Saw it on Gizmag.
That's absolutely right.
All right. Which is better, Bill Belichick or Bruce Arians? So nobody really buys my theory on this. So obviously the answer is Bill Belichick. But here's my theory on Brady. I think Brady went to Tampa. If you heard any of the Howard Stern interview, clearly there's, he wants to be separated from Belichick and to prove that his greatness is not just tied to Belichick. Well, what better way to do that than to go find the worst of the 32 coaches in the NFL and
so
go play for him?
Silly.
No one, when this is done, is going to say, oh, it was Bruce Arians who did it. It'll clearly be Brady. Oh, and by the way, if it fails, you've got a built-in excuse. Hey, look, I didn't go to, like, Sean Payton, even though I could have. I went to Bruce Arians. Of course things didn't work out. I think it's a perfect decision for Brady.
Have you found one taker with this theory yet? I've heard you sharing it a bunch. Have you found one? But no. Has Wassel at least been on your side? Have
nope.
you found one
Tom
person?
Tom specifically
like, oh.
told me I was on my own.
Oh, good. Okay.
I think it's true. The answer is Bill Belichick. Unless we're talking about excuse making, then Arian's number one. All right, which is better? Long walks or long bike rides?
Oh, long walks.
Long walks. Bike riding's terrible.
Oh, so
I like riding. I like walking. Walking's great.
Truly awful.
Yeah.
Unless you're trying to get somewhere. If you want to get somewhere, then biking is great. But even so, you get there and you're sweaty and your butt hurts.
Right. Unless it's downhill. Downhill's great. You get on a bike and you just cruise all the way there.
And then you got to bike back uphill.
Well,
so
yeah,
you're
no,
in a terrible
take
situation.
Take an Uber back. Be crazy. Take the bike downhill and then Uber back.
When was the
terrible.
Last time you went on a long bike ride?
Never. I hate biking long distance. It's so uncomfortable. The seat. Why don't they build bike seats that are meant for, like, human rear ends? Why do they build seats that go up in between instead of ones like, all other chairs?
Have you ever wished you had a callous tailbone? Let me introduce to you this banana seat.
So stupid. Bikes are so uncomfortable.
Ugh. Terrible.
Can you imagine if all the chair, like if an office chair was built like a bicycle seat? Think about how ridiculous it is. Oh, you want to lay on the couch? No, I've got this banana looking seat that goes up between my cheeks. It's so much better.
Ugh.
You got to have function, man. You got to be able to pedal the bike. You can't do it in an office seat.
I want like
Come
a big
on.
Chariot seat on my bike. Then I'll go for a long bike ride. All right, here's a good old school dumb question for which is better. For back when you just have to root for one. New York Stock Exchange, American Stock Exchange, or NASDAQ? Which is better?
I don't know.
I've always been a NASDAQ guy.
I could see that.
I love the NASDAQ.
Of course you do.
Yeah.
Sort of the millennial, next generation.
I'm big into the NASDAQ.
When I was a kid, the NASDAQ was, I think, just maybe it was just coming out or whatever.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, I just would root for the American Stock Exchange. I didn't have any reason why, but I had this memory being like, man, I hope the American Star. I'll check it every day. They would have like two pages next to each other in the Globe, and I'd go and I'd never look at the New York Stock. I was like eight. I'd go look at the American Stock Exchange and see what it was doing.
It's your version of horse racing back in the day.
By the way, the American Stock Exchange has since been bought by the New York Stock Exchange. Like, doesn't exist.
I'm going to say the S&P. How about that?
Oh, you like the S&P 500?
I do.
I can see that. S&P. That seems very you.
Thank you.
I think we're done here. I think that's going to do it for which is better. Thank you.
Okay, can I just add one more thing?
Oh, which one?
We experience as a Hewitt home, the Lucky Charms.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. I was going to try to spare you.
Had a big bowl of Lucky Charms.
When I was six, maybe? Lucky Charms are awful.
Just a few years ago.
They're disgusting.
What?
They're so bad. Them and Trix are the two worst cereals.
Lucky Charms do make me shiver.
They're awful.
I like them, but they make me shiver when I bite them.
Lucky Charms are phenomenal.
Yeah.
I had my first bowl in probably 20 years.
Ugh.
Oh, unbelievably good.
I got to tell you, man, I'm so far out on Lucky Charms. And Trix, too. Trix has like this weird sour sugar taste.
Guy. Yeah, not a Cocoa Puffs or Trix guy. No,
no thank you. All right. Yeah, are we done? That was a lot of fun. This was enjoyable. We got one more before the draft. So we will catch you guys next week. Until then, hey.
Barn.
See you, everybody.
Get to the chopper!